generous hospitality and marriage and education. Well, just to tell people where I come from, here is a map of India, and Bangalore is a southern city. So this is where I come from, and our institute is a little over 100 years old. This was started in 1990, and this is the main building of the institute. And our state is famous for elephants, so you can see lots of elephants. Not on the campus, but in the valley. So all of you are welcome to come and visit the place. The talk that I'm going to give, I have planned it as follows. First of all, I'll give an introduction to what are conjugated systems and why they are important. These are the chemical systems or molecular systems. And then I'll talk about non-interacting models for studying these and their limitations. And then I'll introduce some interacting models. And after introducing the interacting models, I'll talk about the DMRT method for excited states and also the DMRT method for dynamics. There is some application for the excited state and then the dynamic DMRT method, and then that's not right. But conjugated electron materials are extremely important. They are basically extended pi conjugation. I'll tell you what pi conjugation is in a minute. These are mainly polymers and they are very large molecules. One of the simplest is polyacetylene, which is just a carbon chain with hydrogen sticking out at every carbon. And then you have other kinds of more slightly more complicated molecules like polyparaffin with binary rings, oligothiophenes, oligoacenes, etc. What are the applications? These are extremely important because they are used in organic identifying diodes. So basically for display. So today you see display being done using conjugated organic molecules. And there are efforts to get organic photovoltaics and organic thin film transistors and organic. So these are examples of the conjugated molecules. Wherever there is a vertex, put a carbon atom there. And that's what the molecule is. And one also knows that the valency of carbon is 4, so if you see fewer bonds, put hydrogens to saturate the bond. So basically here you have a CH, a CH2, it's a CH2, CH, 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 and then CH2 there. So these are all benzene rings, these are called polyparaffin rings, and these are polyacenes. They are very much like your ladder systems, except that the alternate steps are missing. So these are the alternate steps that are missing. And these are extremely important molecules from the point of view of applications. And these are known as polyparaffin-binary rings, because they are extremely important again from the point of view of applications. Well, where do you start with geometry models? The way you start with geometry models is to look at every one of the carbon atoms. Carbon atoms are in sp2 hybridization, that is, there are three sigma bonds. Which are involved in carbon-carbon bonding and the carbon-hydrogen bonding, and then you also have a pz orbital sticking out at every site. And what you do is, in the chain you have got a pz orbital at every site, and you only concentrate on the pz orbitals because the energetics are such that the sigma orbitals are having energy scales which are very different from the energy scales of the pi orbitals.
So they are deeply bound.
They are deeply bound. They are deep inside. And the pi orbital made the action. So basically you are looking at one orbital per site, and then you have one orbital per site, and then you assume that there is a transfer integral only between bonded carbon atoms, then you get the very famous Hooke model which was introduced way back in 1930s. So this is nothing but the tie binding Hamiltonian in physics for a one-dimensional system or whatever. TIJs are the transfer integrals, and these are the creation and annihilation operators, and alpha I's are the cycle integrals.
In terms of electron occupancy, there is one electron.
Exactly half limit. As it stands in this particular case, these are half limit bands.
And what are the scales of this T, the hopping matrix?
T is usually of the order of about 2 to 2.5 electron volts. So I'm fairly large, broad bands. But basically you have a one-dimensional band, so basically 4T is a band. So of the order of 10 electron volts is a band. 8 to 10 electron volts. So if you look at the carbon chain, so this is a carbon chain that we have in the polyacetylene system. Actually, it breaks up into two subtaxes. One such that any atom in one subtaxis is going to get bonded to the other atoms in the other subtaxis. That is, you have what is called the charge conjugation symmetry at half field, which means you just take interchange like creation and annihilation operators in the Hamiltonian on site A and creation and annihilation operators on site B with a phase of minus one. The Hamiltonian remains invariant, and that is the electron hole symmetry that you have. The polymer also has an inversion symmetry, and you have very weak spin orbit interaction because carbon and hydrogen atoms are very light atoms, so the spin orbit interactions are weak. So the states can be transferred to appropriate spins. And of course, these symmetries lead to very strong experimental predictions. So what are these experimental predictions? One is what's called a Paley theorem. It is something that is known in physics also quite a bit, in the sense that the conduction in the valence bands have a symmetry around a formula, around the zero of the level. So exactly that. So if you have a state of energy minus epsilon k, you have a state of energy plus epsilon k. And these states of energies minus epsilon k and plus epsilon k are called the pi bonding and the pi star of the antibody.
It's a particle pole symmetry.
Particle pole symmetry and half filling. So you have the energy levels occurring in pairs. And of course, the symmetry of the states alternate between A plus and B minus. A and B correspond to the C2 symmetry. So it's A is E1 under C2 and B is odd. And plus minus correspond to the index error charge conjugation symmetry. So what the Paley theorem implies is that the lowest energy excitation is always dipole order. That is, you take an electron from the top of the valence band and put it into the conduction band using electromagnetic radiation, then the matrix element for this transition is non-zero. Which means that the lowest energy excitation is an optically allowed excitation, the dipole allowed excitation. So what the Paley theorem implies is also interesting. So if you are looking at a carbon system which has got odd number of carbon atoms, then what happens is the Paley theorem necessarily says that at least one energy level should be at the zero of the atoms, because all the others are paired. And because the lowest energy excitation is dipole allowed, it also means that if you have odd number of carbon atoms in the thermodynamic limit, the absorption should be at half the energy compared to the even carbon system. That is, you must be having a mid-gap absorption in the hot carbon systems, and the mid-gap means half the gap of what is found in the even carbon systems. Well, here I have just given a schematic of the energy level diagrams. So these are the energies which are always in pair, minus epsilon 1 plus epsilon 1, etc. And this transition is dipole allowed. This is for even polyenes, you have even number of molecular orbitals. If you have odd polyenes, one of the states is at zero, and because the lowest excitation is dipole allowed, you see that the energy of the excitation is 1/2. And if you go to the polymer of the band limit, you have the valence band, the conduction band, and if the optical gap for the even system is Eg, optical gap for the dipole allowed system is Eg by 2. And the odd systems, what happens is chemistry is interesting because you always tend to have strong bonds or shorter bonds at the edges, and as you come to the middle, the bonds become more like single bonds. And so if you have a odd number of carbon atoms, you will have these double bonds or the short bonds to the right and short bonds to the left. And then in the middle, you have a kink. The kink is actually the soliton. So this is the soliton, and continuum models do give this description. And whenever you have a soliton, it's associated with the mid-gap absorption. So this is what the prediction of the one electron theory is. What is the experimental status? Polyacetylene is a acidic conductor because of the pi instability, and valence pi band is filled, conduction band is empty, and the optical gap is about 1.7 electron volts. So the kind of dimerization, that is the short bond, long bond difference in length, is experimentally about 7%. But if you really should have 1.7 electron volts with the optical gap, you require at least 15% dimerization. So it is not experimentally mitigated. The optical gap that you have, the magnitude of the optical gap is much larger than what is expected based on the dimerization system. And there are also evidence for dipole turbulence state during the optical gap. These dipole turbulence states are the ones which are seen in nonlinear spectroscopy. So you can have a two-photon absorption where it takes you from the ground state to the two-photon state, and the two-photon state is below the optical gap of 1.7 electron volts. And you also have triplet states, which are lower. And there is no evidence of big gap absorption in polyimide materials, because people have tried to study that very carefully, but they don't see the big gap absorption. And there's one more thing that's interesting, that is whenever you have an odd number of carbon atoms, then you see that you have the number of electrons in the system is also odd. So which means that there's an unpaired electron present in the system. And this unpaired electron spin density is distributed over the chain. What Hubble theory or the non-interacting picture says is that either you have all the spin densities in one direction at alternate sites, and the spin density between the non-zero sites is zero, so that either you have zero up, that's kind of spin densities. But if you do an electron spin resonance study, then you see that the spin density actually alternates in time. You have an up spin density at one side, at the next side you have a down spin density, up spin, down spin. And these are very clear signatures of electron correlation in the system. And there's another interesting system called symmetric sliding dice, which is very similar to polyacetylenes, except that the end are the nitrogen atoms. Now, people have synthesized these systems with different chain ends for different kinds of substitutions. And what they find is that if they try to get a thermodynamic examination of the optical gap in these kinds of systems experimentally as a function of the conjugation length or the chain length here, then this goes to zero. So the symmetric sliding dice have a zero energy excitation, but on the other hand, the polyacetylenes have a finite energy optical gap. So this is very interesting, and it is kind of against the one part of the picture. Well, as I already said, Hooken model for molecules goes over to the single band tri-banding model for solids. And I have also discussed all these things like incorrect ordering of energy levels and negative spin densities and qualitative because close related systems like the symmetric sliding dice and the polyacetylenes are not explained. Basically, it's a pedagogical value. One of the reasons why the Hooken model was so successful was it explained aromaticity in benzene. It showed why benzene molecule is so much stable, and you had the 4N plus 2 Hooken rule and so forth. So whenever you have 4N plus 2 electrons delocalized in a ring, then it's going to be a very stable system. So that is the reason why the Hubble model became very popular. Now, let me go over the interaction by electron models. So what we are doing is, we are looking at electron-electron interactions within the pi manifold. So we are ignoring the sigma orbitals. And so what we are actually looking at are basically just the one electron per site, and these electrons are the pz orbital. So you have the Hubble molecular, the Hubble Hamiltonian H0, which is the time-bending Hamiltonian, and then you have a general two-electron integral with hopping between the sites. Okay. One of the things that I would like to say is that the way chemists write two-electron integrals is very different from the way physicists write two-electron integrals. In the chemists, the way they write as density repulsion. So when I say IJKL, electron 1 is the overlap charge cloud of orbitals I and j, or the sites I and j, and electron 2 is between k and l. So this is what you write as the integral, and EIJ are just summation over sigma, the hopping of the electron from side to side. So this model again is rather complicated and requires simplification. What are the simplifications people do? There's what's called the zero differential overlap approximation. So if you look at this integral, it depends upon the overlap of the orbital I and j for electron 1, and it also depends upon the differential overlap in k and l for electron 2. So if there are two different sites, if electron 1 is distributed between sites I and j, then the differential overlap is very small. And the same is the case with k and l. So you can assume safely that if electron 1 or electron 2 is between two different sites, then you can actually ignore the 2 electron integral, so that IJKL just becomes IJKL delta IJ delta. So the only 2 electron integrals that you are going to consider are these kinds of 2 electron integrals in which electron 1 is at a given site and electron 2 is on another site, and electron 1 is never in an overlap charge cloud at any point in time. Now, the point is, once you, if you have too many of these integrals, then it becomes very difficult to deal with the model. So people parameterize this PRIJ. So that is, you have this, if you take IIJ parameters, then what you require, what you really get is what's called parallel path total model Hamiltonian. And this is nothing but the Hubbard model plus interaction between size I and PRIJ. And this is a long-range interaction term. And this PRIJ is completely parameterized using both monoparameterization or the Matagami-Shi monoparameterization. So this one, the electron equation integral falls a whole story in this one compared to Matagami-Shimoto. And what we are doing is basically this parameterization for most of the calculations. So if you look at the parallel path total model, which was introduced in the year 1953, basically you have the transfer integral between two different sides, and then you have the on-site electron repulsion when two electrons are on the same orbital, and then you have the inter-site electron interaction.
So this was well before Hubbard model was introduced.
About a decade before the Hubbard model. So the Hubbard model is just this term. So IAJJ term is taken to zero, so it's just a zero plus UI in M and a negative M number two. And so this was 1960. So actually, since the two communities were not talking, so it was not there. Okay. If one is looking at solving these things, you can see that the Hilbert space for the PPP Hamiltonian is finite, just as for any finite Hubbard model or finite Heisenberg chains. PPP model also conserves total spin and the Z component of total spin because spin orbital interactions are quite weak. So a Hilbert space can actually be factorized into various different total S and MS values. So you have you can use a Ruhmer-Pauling basis and factorize it. Only thing is that Ruhmer-Pauling basis is non-orthogonal, but that's not a real problem as far as computations are concerned, because you now know how to solve non-symmetric matrix identity problems as efficient as a symmetric matrix identity problem.
So what you call as Ruhmer-Pauling is what we call as valence bond basis.
Yeah, actually. But the valence bond basis that you use are the ones which are overcomplete. When you have the Ruhmer-Pauling valence bond basis, then the basis is linearly independent and complete. Okay, it's linearly independent and complete. Whereas in your case, it's linearly dependent but complete. So you can actually use full spatial symmetry of any point group and then solve this hard Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Just say one more time, the Ruhmer-Pauling basis. Can you remind me what that is again?
So what happens is, what you do is, supposing I give you a system with two ends, so then
you can use a blackboard.
Suppose you have two end spins. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take the example of n equal to 3. So you arrange the spins at the vertices of a regular hexagon, this one. And then you draw spin couplings, which are possible. You know, like this is one particular spin coupling that is possible. Another one that is possible is this one. A third one that is possible is this one. And fourth one is this, and the fifth one is this one. Okay? But on the other hand, if you look at spin couplings of this type, where the coupling is between sides 1 and 3 and 2 and 4, there's a crossing line. So whenever you have crossing lines, you just throw them off. So throw valence bond diagram where you have got crossing lines. Then the set of valence bond diagrams that you get, which are not having any crossing lines, or the Ruhmer-Pauling valence bond diagrams, which are complete and linear. Okay. So it's very easy to construct these. Okay, so you can do the exact diagnosis methods, but usually, you know, supposing you have looking at a half-filled 14-side problem, you have 2.76 million singlets, and a half-filled 16-side problem has 34 million singlets. So there's very little you can do. So as you go up, then you have exploding dimensions, so the number of the basis is going to increase exponentially, so you cannot really work with exact diagonalization, particularly when systems have very large pi coherence length. That is, it won't reach the thermodynamic limit, for smaller number of sites. So in that case, you cannot do that on that. But of course, they provide really excellent checks for approximate error. So if you are doing any approximate error, using these as checks is very good. So what are the approximate methods that we use in quantum chemistry literature? The approximate methods are what are called very restricted CRD checks. So which means basically you are exciting an electron. You start with your ground state, which is like a filled Fermi scene, and then you make the excitation with your particle over excitation around the Fermi scene. And you, if you are making one particle over excitation, then you get what are called single CIs. This is the famous Tam-Benkhoff approximation in physics, but which in chemistry is called single CI. And you can have double CI, you can have various other kinds of particle interactions. You also have coupled cluster methods, where you may you overcome the problem of size consistency in the restricted CI calculations. Then of course you have quantum Monte Carlo methods, but I think quantum Monte Carlo methods for long range interact with the problem. And then the renormalization methods. So one of the early ones that were tried were the energy eigenvalue based renormalization group methods, RG methods, where they try to keep the lowest few states as the basis states for expanding the system, but that doesn't work out very well. And you have a density weighted eigenvalue based methods, which were introduced in 92 by Steve White, and that's what we have extended in our case. So, in fact, the density matrix based methods are not new to chemistry. In chemistry literature, for dealing with electron correlation problems, they used to use one particle density matrices, and the eigenstates of one particle density matrices were called natural orbitals. And people wrote down your state and determinants using these natural orbitals and obtained very fast convergence for correlation. So the density matrix was known that density matrix eigenstates are very good for actually working with getting fast convergence for correlation. But the DMRG uses, of course, eigenstates of the mini particle density matrix, so it is going to be representing the Fock space instead of just the one particle space. And it also uses renormalization procedure, which means it's going to add, keep iteratively building up your system from a small system to a large system. So basically, you can work with about a thousand or a few thousand density matrix eigenvectors for every iteration. So your Fock space contains about 1,000, 5,000 or 6,000 box density matrix eigenvectors. And this is very accurate for one and quasi system, such as Hubbard, Heisenberg, spin chains, and also polymers. The polymers is something that was not envisaged at that time. Basically, the method was for the Hubbard and the Heisenberg system, basically. Well, the success, of course, depends upon the area law. So what it says is that the entanglement entropy depends upon the area between the system and the surroundings. And the entanglement entropy is a constant in one-dimensional systems because the area between the system and the surroundings is a constant independent of the system size. And so the DMRG cutoff, which goes as E raised to the power some constant A times the entropy of the system, that's the entanglement entropy. So this remains the same for the given axis. So it is not going to keep increasing with the system size, and that's a great advantage because you don't have the entanglement entropy, the constant does not depend upon the system size, at least the way it can be. So you can have a constant cutoff and do the calculation. And of course, when you have long range interactions, it is no longer a one dimensional system in some sense because, you know, long range interactions stochastically. Higher dimensional systems. But nonetheless, what we did was we studied the entanglement entropy of Basel-Powell-Copeland model of up to 16 sites and of the U by T equal to 4 Hubbard models. And we find that the entropies are very, very similar. That's simply because what's happening in the case of Basel-Powell-Copeland model is you are having density-density interactions which are introduced into the system. And because the density-density, the densities are actually not entangled. So if you introduce the term which is actually density-density interaction, the wave function does not get entangled more than what it was in the case of the Hubbard model. Or in other words, if you want to really have entanglement, which is going up, you require off-diagonal interactions. So what we are going to have in the parallel power focal model is only diagonal interactions, and when you have only diagonal interactions, then the entropies are not very different from just the on-site interaction having one, such as the Hubble model.
In general, if density-density interaction tends to localize things, they create a density layer.
Yeah.
And then also the entanglement should go down.
Yeah.
But here, because you are having a half field band there.
Yeah. I also have a transfer term. So when I have a transfer term, then, you know, in a way, you don't have the charge density state is basically a Wigner-Pichler state.
Also, the entanglement now, is it fair to say it's mostly due to spin degrees of freedom? Among spin degrees of freedom, and the charge is not getting affected much by this long range interaction.
By long range interactions, yeah, charge is not getting because the charge
spins are not getting affected.
Yeah, in other words, the charge states which are getting affected are the ones which are at doubly occupied or empty sites.
Yeah.
And when you are having doubly occupied or empty sites, they are not entangled. They are actually pure states, and because they are pure states, so only when the spin states are affected, they are going to have a change in entanglement. And here the charge states are the ones that are getting up. Of course, you can always put it back in the PMRT method can be put back in the form of a matrix product states. It's something that most of people here know better than I do. All that is required is supposing you are doing a finite DMRT sweep, and then you go to the state for an inside system with n-1 left block and n right block states. This the eigenstate can be written in terms of the density matrix eigenvectors of this block times the pure spin state of this n, which is sigma n. Now this can again be written in terms of the density matrix eigenvectors of the n-2 block times the pure spin at side n-1. So if you keep doing it iteratively, then you get this part, and if you get that part, you can actually show that if you represent each one of them as matrices with sigma 1, sigma 2, etc. sticking out at this point, and you contract over the density matrix eigenvectors, then you represent your state as a matrix product state. And that's something that, so what I look at DMRT as probably one of the most convenient methods for doing a very good matrix product state calculation. Well, now let me come back into the polymers. In polymers, what are the important states that we have? The important state is, of course, the ground state, which is a singlet AD plus XCON. Then the lowest dipole excited state, which is a B minus state. And then, of course, you also have a triplet state, which is very important. And then I'll also tell you why the lowest two photon state is extremely important. Two photon state is a state which is actually requires the absorption takes place in third order dynamics. And these are the different states which you will not worry about in this talk. And to get these states, we really need to use symmetry. See, in unsymmetrized methods, what happens is between the singlet AD plus and the singlet BU minus, there are too many intruder states. So these intruder states are triplet states or the quintet states and so on and so forth. So all these intruder states are more like the various spin wave states or the stoner excitation states that exist between the singlet AD plus and the singlet BU minus. And the number of these states depends upon the strength of correlations, size of the system. You cannot predict how many states are going to be there between a singlet AD plus and a singlet BU minus for a given model. It depends upon the interaction strength, and it also depends upon the size of the system. So it's very difficult to target this state because it could be the 45th state in a chain of 8 sites, in a chain of 10 sites, it could be the 56th state, and so on and so forth. And you can only get a few low-lying states, that's the reason why you cannot target that. And the way one goes about is to use symmetries in the P50 and the Hubble models. I already told you about the electron hole symmetry, that is just a size symmetry operator. So you can actually represent the electron hole symmetry of the entire system as a direct product of the electron hole symmetry matrices for each individual size. And similarly, and when you have electron hole symmetry, then what it does is the following. You look at the full space. Full space consists of states with 0 double occupancy, 1 double occupancy, 2 double occupancy, and so on and so forth. So that is the full space. Now, if you take odd space at the electron hole symmetry, then you will see that the only states that you have are those which are highly characterized, one W occupied site or two W occupied site or three and so forth. Whereas for the even electron hole symmetry state, you also have the zero W occupied sites, the one W occupied, two W occupied, and so forth. So this space is what we call the covalent space because it contains states in which you have exactly one electron per site, whereas this space precludes all the states which have just one electron per site. So this is the state, for example, which will have all the spin wave excitations of the system. So the dipole operator is actually connecting these two spaces, which means that if you can get the lowest energy state in this space, you get the AG plus. The lowest energy state in this space will give you the BU minus state. So that you can directly calculate the optical gap from this
one. You mentioned in your introduction that you don't see experimental excitation from ground state to the mid-gap state.
Yeah.
Can you explain in this language?
No.
Because you said the non-interactive picture is dipole alone.
Yeah.
But experimentally you don't.
Experimentally, that's because see what happens is if I do the extrapolation of the optical gap versus 1 upon n, where n is a chain for even Pauline chains and odd Pauline chains, they all lie on the same state.
Okay.
And for any optical excitation, you have to move the charge. So when you move the charge, the most important term that comes is the correlation term. Electron correlation term.
Okay.
When you don't move the charge, then you know you only require the transfer, you know, like the exchange term. So
in other words, if you move an electron and put it in the mid-gap state, there's a local view,
okay,
which is preventing.
Let's look at it this way. The ground state is covalent because you have zero double occupancy. Is that purely in the atomic? And then you want to create a state which is optically allowed excitation.
And into a mid gap.
Which means that you have to put an electron from one side onto another side. So which means you have to create a vacancy in one side and double occupancy on the other side. So this is the one that is actually dipole connected to the covalent state. So if that should happen, then you have an energy U that comes to the picture. So even the mean field calculations don't give you the correct energy gap. So because U is a dominant term for the optical excitation, for the optical gap, so it does not matter whether you have odd number of carbon atoms or even number of carbon atoms. But on the other hand, if it was the non-interactive term which was responsible for the optical gap, then mid-gaps could have come. So the other symmetry is of course the S squared invariance as well as the SZ invariance. S squared invariance is rather difficult to exploit because you have to keep track of the shot coefficients and so forth. So what we did instead was work with MS total equal to zero and then use the symmetry of the Hamiltonian when all the spins are rotated by an angle pi around the y-axis. That is equal to saying that the Hamiltonian is invariant when I flip all the spins up to down and down to up. And this happens in the m is equal to 0. So just as electron hole symmetry means you are changing the mp and the w occupied sides, here you are interchanging the up and the down spin size. So this one also has a following. So if you look at the full space of m is equal to 0, then you have total spin 0, 1, 2, etc. It contains all these things. But on the other hand, if you look at an even space under spin inversion symmetry, then you will only have states 0 to 4, and odd space you will only have 1, 3, 5. Of course, you have user kind of phase factor to know what is even or odd. And then you will see that you have separated the singlet space from the triplet space. So the lowest energy state in this space is a triplet, and the lowest energy state in this space is a singlet. So you will be able to get a singlet triplet using this trick. So, and then you can also use the in the final stage, you can also use the CU symmetry because if I were to write the basis state as a direct product of the density matrix eigenvectors on the left, the raw states on the mu side, sigma and sigma prime, and density matrix eigenvectors on the right, then if I use C2, then I will get to this particular state by the base factor, and I can use this of the symmetry. So I actually have three symmetries, and which means that I have eight subspaces, and I can actually get all kinds of states like EA plus, EA minus, etc. So you can actually get 8 different states. So we did this calculation long back, almost 15-16 years back. And we wanted to see how good the gaps are for U by T equal to 4 Hubbard model and U by T equal to 6. So the exact gap you get is 1.2867T. We can calculate from the Petian's formula. And for U by T equal to 6, it is 2.8926. And you see that the DM1G gaps are 1.278 and 2.895. So as we actually increase U, the gaps are better reproduced. And you will see that these gaps are pretty good, better than 1%. And better than 1% is pretty good for experiments. Okay. Here I have just given you the spin gap. The spin gap of the upper model actually was 0. So it was 0 to about 0.01, so 1% that is. And you will also see that for u equal to 14, u equal to 60, as a function of the number of sides, we work it up to 50 sides. You see that these are the covalent state excitations, which correspond to just the spins twirling around. And these are actually the ionic excitations. And as u by t increases, then you see that these states are getting closer in energy level, and eventually they become the spin wave excitations, and these become the Stoner excitations of the system.
Sorry, if you go to the graph, from the width of the what you call a spin wave excitation, you can get some effective J. Is it reasonable?
Yeah, okay. Let me put it this way. That I'm only looking at the lowest energy states here. So I'm not getting the full spin wave spectrum. So this particular plot is number of sides. As I increase the number of sides, these states are also coming closer together. And as I increase U by T, then the dispersion here is reduced.
But the width should be roughly J.
Yeah, right. Two dispersions. Okay, now having done all this, let's see why it is so important. Okay, there are two very important low-energy excitations in conjugated polymers. These are the lowest one-photon excitation and the lowest two-photon excitation. And in photochemistry, organic photochemistry, there is a very interesting group called the Kasha rule. What the Kasha rule says is that the fluorescence always occurs, the light emission always occurs from the lowest excited singlet state. So if the lowest excited singlet state is dipole anode to the ground state, we have intense fluorescence. If the lowest excited singlet state is dipole forbidden to the ground state, then you have very weak fluorescence. So that's the reason why the 1B RNA is extremely important. So if the 1B is lower in energy because it's a dipole anode state, below the 2 photon state, the polymer is fluorescent. But if the 2 photon state is below the 1 photon state, then the polymer is not fluorescent. So level ordering is controlled by polymer topology, correlation strength, and conjugation. This is something that we actually studied using DMRG. And here I have the crossover between the 2AG and 1BU as a function of U by T. When U increases, then the P state goes up in energy. So this is the P state. This keeps going up in energy, but the A state initially is above, but then it comes down to this point. So you see that there is a crossover of the 2AG and 1BU depending upon the correlation strength. And the 2AG state is actually a two particle hole excitation, the non-interactive picture, and the 1BU state is a one particle hole excitation. So that's the reason why for low U, the P states are always below the U states.
Is there any analog of this in solid state spectroscopy with MOT insulators?
See, eventually, when you are looking at this correlation strength, I'm looking at excited
signals.
When you are looking at the real analogy between MOT insulators and chemical analogy, is actually dissociation of the hydrogen molecule. If you dissociate the hydrogen molecule using quantum chemical methods, which don't take into consideration the correlations, then at infinite distance, you have a dissociation energy which is greater than zero. Okay? And but on the other hand, it has to be zero. That's because your non-interacting picture always has equal weight for H plus, H minus, and H minus, H plus. So always have an admixture of the large U states, even at different separation.
But this level crossing, which you say is due to correlation, has consequences in the sense of fluorescence and no fluorescence.
Yeah, absolutely.
My question is there any inorganic analogy? Kasha rule must be what you say is from organic chemistry.
Yeah. This molecule. Okay, because what happens is that when you excite an electron across to a potential energy surface on top, then no matter what state you are looking at, so from S0 you excite to Sn. But because of the crossing between the potential energy surfaces to the Sn, Sn minus 1, and so on and so forth, and because of Born-Oppenheimer violating terms, you will see that the state very quickly comes down to S1. And from S1 to A0, there is a gap, and then you have the fluorescence. Of course, S1 to A0, you need not always have a gap, because there is an example of assuming which is where you have fluorescence from S2 components. This is, the Kasha rule is only a rule, it's not a theory. Okay, so here I have shown how, as a function of the dimerization delta, that is, we make the transfer integrals as T times 1 plus minus delta, and that is the delta I am looking at. And if delta is very large, then you would see that the 2AG state is lower in energy, and when delta becomes large, delta becomes rather, when delta is large, the 1BU state is lower in energy, and when delta becomes when delta is small, the 1BU state is lower in energy, and when delta is large, the 2AG state is lower in energy. That's because the delta is going to split the spectrum. So if you are looking at 2 electron, 2 hole excitation, that's going to be very much higher than that. So the 1BU state is lower in energy. And as you keep increasing delta, then you see that the 2AG state goes up and the 1BU state goes up. And you also have other kinds of very interesting in this system. That is, you see, you look at the 1B and the 2A states, and the 1BU state is actually an extended excitation, whereas the 2A excitation is a very localized excitation. So as a function of chain length, the 2A state, saturates very quickly, but the 1B state comes down in slowly. So you see that as a function of chain length, there's a crossover between the 1B and the 2A, which is actually seen in polyenes. In polyenes, experimentally seen that for longer polyenes are fluorescent, but the shorter polyenes are not fluorescent. Okay, so that's because of this quantum confinement of the excitation of the 1B excitation, which makes its energy very high in shorter chains. And here is a case of polyacenes. So in the case of polyacenes, I just want to show you that in the limit of thermodynamic limit, the gap goes to like 0.6 to 0.7 electrons, which is very, very small compared to the gaps. And you see that there is also a crossover of the polyacenes, single 1p and the 2a states around 5. So all the polyacenes up to 5 rings are fluorescent, and longer than 5 rings are not fluorescent. And this is known now, experimentally also is known.
So this is an explanation of your Kasha.
Yeah, explanation of Kasha rule, but there's a crossover of the 1B and the 2A in the polyacenes that occurs. And so that's what I have mentioned. See, when we looked at these systems, polyacene systems, one of the important things is that in organic photovoltaic cells, one is interested in multi exciton generation. That is, you use one photon and excite from S0 to S1. And from S1, if you can get two triplets, let's say, then you will see that you have two particles, two holes to separate, and so the current increases and the photovoltaic efficiency increases. So the idea is whether you can use just one photon excitation to create more than one exciton, which can actually be split, and you will have a higher efficiency to the photovoltaic cells. So looking at polyacenes, we thought that these are having very low triplet gaps, so then probably this will give you pretty good multi-exciton generation. And indeed, people have done these experiments recently in Cambridge, Richard Friend's group, and they do find higher cross sections for multi-exciton generation in data sinks and data sinks.
So in the usual semiconductor, this will be less probable because it's weakly correlated.
Yeah, it's because it's weakly correlated. You know, when you have, see, in this particular case, the exciton binding energy is very high. Because of that, you have states which are way below the conduction bandage. Okay? So when you excite to the conduction bandage, from there you can create two excitations to the valence bandage. Okay? So, the reverse process is also important in molecules, because people think that if you create triplets, and then the triplet-triplet annihilation can give rise to excited singlets, which can give you light. So, both for organic item emission and for organic photovoltaics, they consider this process. So, I think one of the systems that I wanted to discuss is the fused resonance systems. Fused resonance are interesting in the sense that you have a 7-member ring and a 5-member ring. And it is almost, this is the way you can write down when you want to do a DMRT building up of the system. So you can build up the system using as though it's a ladder with a step that's coming up, which is at an angle and a vertical step.
So not a useful ladder, but.
That's it.
But what?
So if you look at this system, this is a 5-member ring and this is a 7-member ring. And the Hucker rule says that this should have a negative charge and this should have a positive charge. So you must be having a dipole moment in this as well. And so you are also looking at the system and said that look, it is a frustrated system. Because it is a frustrated system, the single triplet capsule will be rather small. So what we did was we did some spin gaps in these azulene systems. And we found it very interesting for as a function of the chain. So, when you have very short azulenes, you will see that the MS equal to 0 state is the ground state. But when the azulenes become larger than 5 units, then the MS equal to 0 and the MS equal to 1 state become degenerate and the state becomes a triplet state. The ground state becomes a triplet state. And when you go to even longer chains of azulenes, like 10 azulene units, you see that the MS equal to 2, the MS equal to 1, and the MS equal to 0, all the three become degenerate, giving you a spin 2 system. So it looks as though as you keep increasing the system size, then you are going to have higher and higher spin ground states. So it's possible that in the bulk system, you will have a magnetism which is completely because of frustration and nothing to do with things like flat back magnetism. Because if you want to have flat band ferromagnetism, then you must have a degeneracy of the molecular orbitals. We find that in this system, the degeneracy of the molecular orbitals or non-interacting orbitals is not high. And in order to confirm that, we also look at the Heisenberg speed chains. When you look at the Heisenberg speed chains, you can actually work with up to about 24 or so. So you see that initially, MS equal to 0 is the ground state. And then MS equal to 1 state comes down in energy, the MS equal to 2 state comes down in energy, MS equal to 3, MS equal to 4. So this is what Pascal was telling me this morning, is like an Anderson tower. Apparently this is something that Anderson was predicted in some of these systems. So it looks like fused resonance systems are going to be ferromagnetic.
Or some kind of, more like anti-ferromagnetic.
Anti-ferromagnetic interaction with ferromagnetization.
You're saying that this is the tower of states, Anderson's tower.
Exactly, because one by one it's.
Well, the towers are collapsed.
Show me that again. Just
C's.
Oh, it's one over.
MS equal to 0 is the ground state, MS equal to 1 comes down, MS equal to 2, MS equal to 3, MS equal to 4. So as you keep increasing the chain, length of the chain, then higher and higher speed states are becoming ground states. So this is what I've actually put down here. And we also looked at the polarization of the system, which is up to 16 rings, 18 rings, and 20 rings. And this is the excess charge in the 5-member system and the excess charge in the 7-member ring. So you see that the amplitude does not come down. It's amplitude remains almost the same all through. So it looks like this both, and which means that there's a dipole moment which is actually building up. So you have a system where you have a ferroelectric coil as well as a ferromagnetic or a bulk magnetization. So this is something like a multi-ferroelectric, which is molecular enough, completely molecular material, just a polymer which can show you multi-ferroelectric property, that is bulk magnetization and bulk polarization. So I'll just talk a little bit about dynamic response functions. So dynamic response functions are very basically the response functions corresponding to an operator O, and the intensity of the response is just given by this matrix element. And this was usually in the physical literature one does these calculations using the Langevin scheme. So basically you get a ground state, from the ground state you construct another initial state which is given by this quantity, and from this initial state you do another Langevin and then obtain a new set of matrix elements for a matrix element HL, and then I omega of the response function is just given by a continued fraction summation of this quantity. And this was something that Karen Halbert used in Heisenberg spin system. In the chemistry literature, what they do is somewhat different. The chemistry literature, they just write down I omega in this form, which is a summation over the excited states R, and I should put a summation sign here. So, and they just restrict the summation to about 50 excited states, 100 excited states, whatever they can. So that's called the sum of states, and it involves an uncontrolled truncation of the system. Then we use what's called the correction vector technique, in which we define a correction vector p1 omega as by this equation, which is a solution of this linear inhomogeneous algebraic equation. And you can see that p1 omega is actually can be written as a sum over CRR, R of the excitations, where the coefficient is just given by one of these terms which appear in the response function calculation. And the whole thing is that when you are looking at these things, the response function I omega can be just written as a matrix element of the operator O with the ground state and the response function, and you can solve for the response function by actually setting up linear algebraic equations, which I have shown here how to set up the linear algebraic equations, and you can solve them very much like using the Davidson algorithm, except that it is also a small matrix algorithm, very similar to Davidson, very efficient. Using this, we computed the linear polarizability of polymers as well as the third order generation coefficients of the polymers. And here I'll show you some results that we got for checking purposes. We showed that from the DMR you can get alpha exact, almost correct to, you know, better than 1%, and gamma you can also get to better than 1%. In fact, the dominant components are extremely exact, and this is something that the correction method allows you to do. And we studied different kinds of dendrimer systems. I will not go into these things, but basically they give you how the beta and the alpha scale as a system size. But in the remaining 5 minutes or so, what I'll do is I'll just talk a little bit about the real-time dynamics that we did in recent years. Real-time dynamics is important in conjugated organic systems because it is used for understanding spin charge separation, electron hole recombination, fluorescent resonant energy transfer, and various such processes. All it means is that you construct a wave packet psi and you orbit using the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and then project psi and then calculate the property from the time you are doing that. So, for the spin charge separation, the kind of wave packet we use was we obtained the ground state from the DMR for a long enough chain, and then annihilated the electron drop spin inside one, and that was the wave packet. And we wanted to at least we drove the first side, the hole, and we wanted to see how this hole was actually propagating. To see that, we have to calculate psi of t and then calculate ni of t and psi of t. That tells you what is the radio, what is the time evolution of the charge and the spin density at various sites. And the method that one uses is basically multi-step differential technique, which is extremely efficient. One need not solve the homogeneous linear algebraic equation, and it is just propagating the wave function using four different points at previous times, like 2 delta t to 4. Like at times t equal to 0, delta t, 2 delta t, 3 delta t, and 4. Well, what is the problem with time evolution using PMR? One of the major problems with time evolution using DMR is the following. So if you look at the full Hilbert space is something like this, and the DMR space at time t equal to 0 is this blue beam here that I have in the middle. Now supposing I start my wave packet somewhere here and start propagating it, you will see that very quickly the Hilbert space in which the wave packet has maximum projection just goes out of the DMR space. So you cannot have long enough time evolution if you use just static Hilbert space for time evolution. So what you really need to do is to time lock the Hilbert space. That means you keep on changing the Hilbert space as you keep changing, as you keep evolving your wave packet. And this is something that has been done by various people, but we use a slightly different technique which we call the double time window targeting technique, where we average the estimate is over 2 delta t. And then time you all over time delta t in small steps of delta tau. And then when we come here, we again average the estimate is over delta t, this delta t and the next delta t, and go on, so on and so forth. So that's how we do the time evolution. And here is how the charge and the spin transport occurs. So this is the charge evolution. So you can see that I have looked at up to 45 upper chains and BPP chains, and you see that in fact the way the first leap that we are going to have corresponding to the hole having moved from one side to the last side, you see that that is scaling uniformly with like size of the chain. And if you look at the spin is evolving much more slowly. So that you can directly see that the spin velocities are much lower than charge velocity. And usually the spin velocity to charge velocity ratio is 1/2 for the PPP models. And for other models, it of course depends upon the strength of the electron average. And we have done these time evolutions for different kinds of polymers so far, like polymers with substitutions and so forth. Again, using the density renormal distribution method. And let me summarize our technique. So, molecular electronic materials based on complicated organics are very strongly impacted because they are low dimensional materials. There is not enough space, phase space for the electrons to avoid each other, so they repel each other very strongly. And these states are modeled by Hamiltonians like the Parseval-Popov model. And we show that entanglement entropy of eigenstate of parallel power of focal chains is comparable to those of upper chains. And so DMR unit is best suited for solving these molecular eigenstates. And DMR unit is extended to target desired states. Obtain frequency dependent linear and non-linear response. And it can also be efficient real time DMR to the target based on the wave pattern dynamics. So, thank you.
I have two questions. One is there any organic system where magnetism is more manifest in the sense of visible magnetic order?
Oh yeah, we have many. Yeah. For example, a C16 probe with rubidium. This is RBCS C16. RB1.5 CS.
So yeah, that's bulk.
So that's a ferromagnetic Curie temperature of 32 Kelvin. And then you also have other this is multiple, like what about gamma phase of you know they are called para nitrophenyl nitrogen nitroxenes. Okay, so which is basically dietal molecule.
You see ferromagnetism.
You see ferromagnetism with 0.65 billion is Curie depression. And I'm sure that there are also more systems now with the higher Curie.
My second question, how popular is this DMRG method among theoretical chemists? Because in the literature I see mostly configuration interaction or DM.
Yeah. See, one of the problems I think with quantum chemistry is that they are very heavily tied to existing codes, the package codes. So they don't want to move away from it because it's thousands and tens of thousands of lines. So they don't want to move away from it. So that's why, and one thing, and second thing is DMRG method is mainly for modern. It is not good for ab initio. Because ab initio Hamiltonian is the eigenstates of too much time. So you cannot do the DMRG factor. And model Hamiltonian is something that is not very popular in chemistry, as in, you know, unlike in physics.
But you are showing it is indeed useful.
Oh, it is indeed.
So when you do your time evolution, are you increasing the number of states you keep as a function of time?
No. For the same end, the estimate is again vectors keep changing. So as we sweep back and forth, so we are looking at average density matrix, average reduced density matrix, and the eigenstates of the average reduced density matrix is what we are concerned. And this average reduced density matrix is going to change with time. So the space is still 4m-dimensional, but within the 4m-dimensional space, then how many, what are the m states that we are going to keep, keeps varying.
Question? That's my question.